Good evening. Tonight I want to return to particle physics, that esoteric part of physics that's been turned upside down in the past 18 months by a series of quite unexpected discoveries. The result has been electrifying. Professor Abdus Salam of Imperial College London and the Institute of Theoretical Physics at Trieste puts it like this.
It's really so overwhelming, the amount of new data and totally unexpected things which are coming along. That's the real excitement. This is a totally new chapter in particle physics.
So what's going on, and where will it lead? 2 weeks ago, the Royal Society organized a conference in London which brought together the experimentalists responsible for the new discoveries and the theoreticians who are now trying to make sense of them. And this evening, I'll be talking to Abdus Salam, whom you've just heard, as well as to Professor Burton Richter from Stanford University in California, and to Professor David Klein, who works at the National Accelerator Laboratory near Chicago. First, though, let me remind you of how this wave of excitement began. In November 1974, two groups of experimentalists announced the discovery of a new particle of matter. At Stanford, Burton Richter and his colleagues were working with a new machine called SPEAR, in which ordinary electrons, which have a negative electric charge, and positive electrons are made to travel at high speed, but in opposite directions, around what's called a storage ring. At various points along the circumference, the positive and negative electrons collide with each other. Richter discovered that when the total energy of the colliding electrons and positrons was the equivalent of roughly 3,100 million volts, 3.1 GeV, as the high-energy physicists say, the two kinds of electrons were much more likely to interact with each other, producing different kinds of particles in the process, than when the energy was either slightly greater or slightly less. What surprised him and his colleagues was the narrowness of the band of energy in which these E plus, E minus interactions took place. And following a line of argument that's quite familiar in high-energy physics, he was led to the conclusion that this curious behavior implied the existence of some previously unknown particle of matter whose mass must be the equivalent of 3.1 GeV of energy. GeV, by the way, stands for giga electron volts. At the same time, but quite independently, and on the eastern seaboard of the United States, Professor Sam Ting and his colleagues, working at the Brookhaven National Laboratory with a quite different kind of particle accelerating machine, it accelerates protons and not electrons, found quite different evidence to show that the same particle exists. At Brookhaven, the new particle was called the J particle. At Stanford, they christened it the Psi. And at Stanford, 10 days after the first discovery, they found a second particle, which they called the Psi prime or Psi dashed, this time with a mass corresponding to an energy of 3.65 GeV. It's important, I think, to ask precisely why these new particles were a surprise. First, Richter's observation that electrons and positrons interact strongly only in a very narrow band of energy, about 100,000 volts or so, instantly signaled to the physicists that the Psi particles were unexpectedly stable. They might survive for nearly a millionth of a microsecond before disintegrating, and that's much longer than the lifetimes expected for particles with a mass as heavy as 3.1 GeV. It's worth remembering, of course, that this lifetime, which may be long by the standards of the unstable particles of matter with which the high-energy physicists were previously familiar, is nevertheless exceedingly short when it comes to trying to make measurements. Even if a Psi particle were traveling with a speed of, shall we say, a tenth of the velocity of light, it wouldn't be able to travel for a thousandth of a millimeter before disintegrating into other particles. So the Psi particles can be recognized only by the products of their spontaneous disintegration. And in any case, they're electrically neutral, which means that they can't be recognized by means of their interaction with the matter through which they pass. There's another sense, however, in which the new particles were to begin with, not so much a surprise as a fulfillment of earlier speculations by the theoretical physicists. For more than 10 years, people have been toying with the notion that all the familiar particles of nuclear matter, the particles which can interact with each other by means of the nuclear forces that hold atomic nuclei together, are made up of particles called quarks. The simplest picture is that all particles of nuclear matter, stable particles like protons and neutrons, but also unstable particles such as the mesons and certain heavier analogues of protons and neutrons, which are also unstable, all these are various combinations of three quarks. This three-quark model was able to account for all the particles known to exist up until November 1974. But long before then, the theoreticians had persuaded themselves that there should be a fourth quark. Some suggested that this extra quark was necessary to give a certain symmetry to the way in which the various particles of nuclear matter are described, and they called it the charmed quark. Charm is just a name for a new property of particles of matter, philosophically on a par with attributes of particles of matter such as electric charge, for example. Other theoreticians had been led to a similar conclusion, that a previously unknown attribute of particles of matter must exist to rationalize the relationship between the particles of nuclear matter and the particles of electronic matter, called leptons. And this attribute of particles of matter they called color. Again, it's just a name. So, in November 1974, it was natural to look for an explanation of the new psi particles in terms of either charm or color. But which? That the psi particles did represent a new kind of matter was clear from the start. But as you will hear, it's still not clear whether the new character of particles of matter is charm or color or possibly something else. In the hectic days after the first discovery, Richter's group at Speer was chiefly responsible for pinning down the properties of the two psi particles, their electric charge, their spin, and so on. And in retrospect, it's quite remarkable that so much was done in so short a time. I asked Burton Richter how it came about that he and his colleagues were so quick off the mark.
We were already pretty well organized as an experimental group. We were a very large group, 35 physicists. And one of the first things that happened at the laboratory was the theoretical group at our laboratory organizing themselves to work as our assistants. Usually the theorists and experimenters are pretty well apart. They talk to each other. But then at that time, we had the entire theory department organized in platoons, companies, regiments, each working on various facets of the implications of these studies. And I think it was really very useful to us, and it let us make progress probably faster than we would have without their help. Not in the sense of gathering data, the machinery was all set up and built to gather data, but pointing out to us, almost faster than we could think about it, what the implications of this particular process were, or that decay modes, and what questions it raised, and how you could best analyze the data to settle one question or another question, and to find out more information on what these things really were.
In a sense, you did, as it were, uncover a whole new field of speculation and inquiry a year and a half ago. In the organization of the work, what part do you play? Are you the general in command, or are you a person who argues with other people and produces a view by consensus, as it were, what should be done next? How do decisions get made?
I see. That's an interesting question, and I have never speculated out loud on how the group actually works. With a group which is really four groups, it means it's full of a whole bunch of very strong-minded people. And I guess I am, in some sense, the general, but I don't like to work that way. I like to get a consensus and convince people of what we should do. I'm the general because I have been working on this for a long time, much longer than any of the other people who are interested in the subject. And my group not only includes the physicists who use the machine, but my group actually built the machine, too. And so I have inherited this mantle all these other people sort of have the opinion that Speer is really mine, and when it comes down to it, they'll give a little, but not much, deference.
Is it your opinion, too, that Speer is yours? Do you think of it as a personal creation, as indeed, I might say, you would be entitled to? How attached are you to it emotionally?
I think I would probably tend to think of Speer as mine as long as I think it's the most important tool to use to learn things about physics. I built that machine because more than 10 years ago I became convinced that this E plus E minus reaction would teach us things about the strong interactions and about particle physics that you couldn't learn any other way. It's enormously satisfying to see that prediction come true. And there is a feeling of personal pride in seeing the results come out of Speer, and also in seeing so many other people get interested in the E plus E minus business too.
Burton Richter with an account of how work of this kind is carried out by groups of physicists, theoreticians as well as experimentalists, dancing attendance on a huge accelerating machine. Since then, other groups of physicists have joined in, and those lucky to work with machines for colliding electrons and positrons together have played an especially important part, the German group at Hamburg, for example. But now the powerful proton accelerators have also joined in the hunt for new particles. The National Accelerator Laboratory, or the Fermi Lab as it's called, in Chicago, and CERN in Geneva. So where do we stand now? What's happened since the discovery of those first two psi particles? Here's Burton Richter.
There are now a family of at least five heavy particles, all of which are produced directly in the E plus E minus annihilation. Two of those are the psi and its slightly heavier brother, known for short as the psi prime.
Those are at energies of 3.1 GeV and 3.5 GeV.
3.1 and 3.7. And those have this very peculiar property, which started all the excitement, of having very long lifetimes compared to conventional elementary particles. Shortly after that, within a few months after that, we found a big, broad bump in the production cross-section at about 4.1 GeV. That looked like a third. Since that time, we have spent more time going over this 4 GeV region, and it turns out that that region now has at least three. And those three, rather than being very long-lived like the psi and the psi prime, are rather short-lived, and they're quite like the lifetimes of the other normal elementary particles we know at lower masses. Then in addition to that lower bound of five, because there may still be more, there are at least three more which have been observed in the decays of the psi, that is the psi or the psi prime, in fact, decays via one way or another to another narrow state, a new particle of long lifetime, and then it in turn decays. Picking these out of the data is a more subtle job than just looking at the big increase in the cross-section when you hit one that's directly produced. But we can say now that the lower bound on the members of the new family is eight particles.
That's a lot, and you imply that they're more possibly still to be found. How well do they fit into people's earlier pictures of quarks and charmed quarks and so on? Is there a scheme which can accommodate these eight new particles?
Well, the scheme which is most popular in the theoretical community, and probably in the entire high-energy physics community now, is the one that you have mentioned, the scheme involving charm quarks. And that scheme predicts an energy level structure for the states of the charm quark and its anti-quark, which is much like the hydrogen atom. And so there's a ground state, that's the psi. There's a first radial excitation, that's the psi prime. There's a second radial excitation, that's the 4.1 wide one. There are a collection of orbital p states, those are some of the ones seen in the decays. There are a collection of orbital d states, those are the narrow ones, or excuse me, not narrow, they're narrower than the 4.1 which are seen up in that region too. So that scheme, the CHARM scheme, is flexible and can accommodate these particles. It can accommodate a few more. If you get too many more, that scheme will be in trouble. There's another scheme, not so popular, called COLOR. I'm sorry about the names.
You can't help that.
I can't help that. It's the puckishness of the theoretical community that dictates these things. So the COLOR scheme, as far as the directly produced particles go, can accommodate five and only five. And two of them must be narrow and three of them must be wide. And for the directly produced particles, that's exactly what you see right now. Another particle directly produced in this region, I think, will be the death knell of the COLOR scheme. Not the CHARM scheme. Those people are only momentarily embarrassed by new particles before the scheme is modified and they're fitted in.
Yes, and on the charmed quark scheme, each of these particles consists of a charmed quark and its antiquark bound
right.
together.
That's right.
As are the two particles in a hydrogen atom, as you put it just now. Now, what about the other discoveries in the past year? There's been a lot of talk, for example, about the possibility of there being a new heavy lepton, a kind of heavier member of the family of the electron and the mu meson.
Well, that talk is generated by some more events which were found at Spear by the same group, most of the analysis being done by Martin Pearl, who you interviewed recently. This is the finding of two particles which don't belong together, finding of states which have a mu meson and an electron in them. Now, from all we know about particle physics, those two things should not be there together unless they are produced as a decay product of other particles. So something is happening and some new kind of particle is produced which decays to a muon for one of them and an electron to the other one. The question is what kind of particle. There are two explanations which are the ones people think of first. One, that there is a new heavy lepton, something like the mu meson, which in turn is heavy compared to the electron, the lowest of the mass of the charged leptons. The other is that these are somehow decay products of charmed particles now, not charm quark anti-quark combinations, but the charm quark with a normal quark. And that it's the decays of those particles which account for the muon and the electron that we see. Now, the data is not sufficiently extensive right now to make a clean-cut decision one way or the other. You can apply all kinds of tests, and all those tests favor the hypothesis that it is a new heavy lepton. But they don't favor it so overwhelmingly that I'd be willing to bet very much money, although I'd be willing to bet some, that these things were not charmed particles.
In practice, one surely has to assume that if you can get a charmed quark and its antiquark bound together to give one of the new psi particles, that one should also be able to get particles that consist of a charmed quark bound to another. I mean, the second hypothesis for the mu electron production must surely represent at least particles that exist somehow, somewhere. Is that fair?
That's absolutely fair, and one of the biggest problems in particle physics now is where are the charmed particles? Events have been seen in other machines and other kinds of reactions, which involve, again, two leptons in the final state. In particular, there are events involving two muons found in experiments done with neutrino beams at the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory in the US. Now, the explanation for the second muon, the first comes naturally with the neutrino interaction, is that the neutrino interactions have produced a charmed particle and it has decayed to give the second muon. There are events at CERN in the Gargamel bubble chamber involving a muon and an electron, which are also explained the same way. There aren't many of them, there are only four of those. And there are about 10 events involving a muon and an electron in the Fermi Lab big bubble chamber. Now, all of those can be explained on the hypothesis that you produced a real charmed particle and it decayed. But charm particles, if they're produced, should decay other ways too. You should be able to see the decay into normal particles. You should be able to measure the momentum of those normal particles and reconstruct the mass of a charm particle. Lots of experiments have tried, and nobody has succeeded. And it's getting more and more mysterious where these charm particles, in fact, are. If they don't turn up in, maybe another year or so, the charm hypothesis is going to be in bad trouble. And the reason I gave it as long as a year is that the limitations imposed by recent experiments are going to require some new kinds of apparatus to be put together to search in the decay modes which haven't been tested so far.
The decay modes other than those involving, shall we say, a pair of muons or a muon and an electron.
Right.
Suppose it turns out that the mu electron events are eventually interpreted unambiguously in terms of a new heavy lepton. Won't that make trouble for these theoretical schemes?
I find the prospect fascinating. Once is an accident and twice has got to be fundamental. We have a heavy lepton, the mu meson, and it turns out to be very close in mass to the lowest mass of the ordinary strongly interacting particles, the pi meson. If it turns out that we get a new heavy lepton, and at the same time you get a new collection of elementary particles, again at the same mass, and there must be something much more fundamental in the connection between leptons and the strongly interacting particles than people have thought before. It will give a little problem if there is a lepton to the simple charm scheme. One of the reasons that charm was invented was to close a gap between the number of quarks and the number of leptons. If you look at theories of the weak interactions and the neutrino interactions, to make them nice and clean and pretty, you want the same number of leptons as quarks. We have four leptons, two neutrinos, the electron and the muon, and there were only three quarks before, and the charm quark was a nice way to handle a whole bunch of problems. If charm exists and the heavy lepton exists, the weak interaction theories don't work anymore. And the only way you could make them work is to add in still more quarks. And then it will be very amusing when the next generation of machines come along to see whether there is a new threshold and a new family of particles which go with these new quarks, and whether there's a new heavy lepton which keeps you from closing the scheme again. In fact, there are some people who think that this will be an infinitely repeating sequence. I don't think so. I'd like to think that the sequence stops. But the one thing I would really like to see is a unification between the leptons and the quarks or the strongly interacting particles. It just looks to me as if that has to be true.
Why is it that these low energy state particles, the psi and the psi primed, have such long lifetimes?
That's a question which as yet doesn't have an answer. In the high energy physics world, the name that's associated with this is Zweig. Zweig has a rule, and everybody says that these things are so long-lived because they violate Zweig's rule.
And what is Zweig's rule?
Zweig's rule in terms of the quark model says that you can't have processes which involve disconnected quarks. That is, if you look at a particle which is going along and has a certain quark content, those quarks can't all vanish and turn into new kinds without having the process inhibited a great deal. Now, in the charm model of these heavy particles, the psi and the psi prime are both composed of a charm quark and an anti-charm quark. They can't decay into charm particles because charm particles are too heavy. They're below threshold for that. To decay into normal particles, both the charm quark and the anti-charm quark must disappear.
Simultaneously.
Right. They must disappear simultaneously, and you must have reappearing the normal kinds of quarks. That is a Zweig rule violating process, and it's supposed to be inhibited. Now, poor Zweig never said that that was the reason for this. He invented that rule to explain some reactions which happened and some reactions which didn't happen in the interactions of the lower mass elementary particles. And it turns out when you try and draw pictures of what happens to the quarks, if the quark lines are disconnected, that is, if a quark must vanish from the process and turn into something new, the reaction is inhibited. The problem with Zweig's rule in this high-energy regime is it seems to work even better at high energies than it does at low energy, and that's an anomaly. We usually find these partial conservation laws break down the higher you go in energy. And it would be easy to explain a factor of 100 inhibition in the decay rate or a factor of 100 longer lifetime on the basis of Zweig's rule. What you actually see is 1,000 to 10,000. The color model has a little bit easier time, but not much. It has a natural mechanism to suppress the decay modes by about a factor of 100, but it's also missing the other factor of 10 or 100 to get down to the actual decays of the Si prime. Both these models then have troubles of the same order.
Yes, but still, there is an empirical rule, as it were, that will justify this.
There's an empirical rule. The empirical rule makes me rather uncomfortable. It doesn't have any dynamical basis that we know of yet. And you hate to see such fundamental things as the extremely long life of these particles hanging totally on a heuristic rule.
Several things emerge from what Richter said. The simplest explanation of the new psi particles is that they consist of a new fourth quark and its anti-quark, linked to each other just as the proton and the electron are linked together in a hydrogen atom, but by different forces. The eight versions of the psi particle now known can then be explained as different states of this pair of quarks model. The trouble is that so far, there's no way of telling from the data whether the new attribute of matter that's been discovered is what the theoreticians have been calling charm or color. And indeed, it may turn out to be something quite different. Indeed, neither scheme as it stands will adequately account for the long lifetimes of the psi particles. And at the Royal Society conference, a great many of those who invoked Zweig's rule, which Richter distrusts, did so with their tongues in their cheeks. The phrase Zweig's rule has become a euphemism for inexplicable. And there's another thread to the story, which is a severe challenge nobody has successfully taken up so far. You'll recall that I asked Richter about what's called the heavy lepton. That's yet another new particle, or the shadow of a new particle. The evidence for it first turned up at Stanford, where Richter and his colleagues were surprised to find that the ultimate products of collisions between electrons and positrons often included pairs of electrons and mu mesons, particles of matter which are, for all practical purposes, heavier versions of the electron. This suggested that a still heavier version of the electron might exist. In the past year, more direct evidence for the existence of a heavy lepton has come from experiments at CERN and at the Fermilab, where people have fired streams of neutrinos. They're also leptons, or members of the electron family, but which have no mass and no electric charge. They've fired them at various targets. To begin with, people had to look for the products of the nuclear reactions. More recently, they've been able to see how these particles arise by using bubble chambers like the Gargamel bubble chamber at CERN. One of the people concerned is Professor David Klein, and so I asked him what he now has to say about these heavy leptons a year after the first reports of their existence began to appear.
We can say that the particle mass is about 2 GeV. We can say it's very likely a charged particle. We can say its lifetime is definitely less than 10 to the minus 11 seconds. We don't know if it's really 10 to the minus 13. We can say that one way or another, the production of this particle is associated with another quantum number, which is called strangeness, which was discovered 25 years ago, partially here in England. We do not yet know what the connection is with strangeness. We know that there's a deep connection because the same phenomenon.
When it decays, it produces strange particles.
Well, what we have specifically, I have to be very careful and just say what we observe, because everything else is sort of interpretation. We initially discovered this effect with a large counter experiment, which means a large array of detectors, which we don't see inside. They're done with electronics. And later, the bubble chamber, the large bubble chamber at Fermilab, started observing the same effects. Now, it was not until one saw the effects in the bubble chamber you could tell whether there were strange particles or not. The counter experiment just couldn't tell. And now that the effect has been seen in the bubble chamber, it's clear that nearly every event associated with this new particle has at least one additional strange particle. Now, that's extremely unusual. We've never seen anything like this before in nature. The best theorists do not understand what's going on, but there's still, from an experimental standpoint, clearly some association between these particles and strangeness. What the nature of the association is, we don't know until we find a lot more events.
David Klein's reference to strangeness is an apt historical comment on the upheaval now going on in high-energy physics. More than a quarter of a century ago, two British groups of physicists, one in Manchester and one in Bristol, discovered particles of matter called V particles and tau mesons, which couldn't be fitted into the then accepted scheme of things. Ultimately, they were accounted for by adding to the list of attributes of matter, or the list of quantum numbers, as the theoretical physicists are inclined to say, a new attribute of matter called strangeness. That concept has stood the test of time, and superficially the present situation is very much the same. It's necessary somehow to build a framework that accommodates an extra attribute of the particles of matter. The trouble is that the present situation is much harder to understand. It's not just a question of accommodating the new psi particles, but the new heavy leptons as well. Already, at the Royal Society conference, people were suggesting that it might be possible to do the trick by supposing that there are six different kinds of quarks. But obviously, there's a limit to how far that kind of explanation can be extended without undermining the credibility of the whole idea. And everybody is conscious that nobody has yet found a quark as such, and that it's becoming more and more essential that any framework of explanation must link the family of particles of electronic matter and the particles of nuclear matter coherently together. So I asked Abdus Salam what the theoreticians are doing, and in particular, what's now to be made of the theories based on the concepts of charm and colour.
Both rival theories are, of course, at the moment competing with each other in predicting. It's curious. Some of the resonances fit better with one hypothesis, some with the other. And personally, I believe that both quantum numbers have been excited, they both exist, and that we are seeing a medley of the two. But this is a sort of compromise attitude. For example, the color prediction is that spin one objects should be five in number. And at the moment, there are exactly five. So today, Professor Matthews will be delighted to present that evidence. If they increase more than five, he will have to then modify the premises of the theory or admit that there is also the excitation of the charm at the same time. Personally, I believe this is what's going to happen.
Yes, so that we must look forward to a period of some years during which the two theories will jostle with each other and in due course something quite different.
Or there may be a totally different theory.
That's right.
We may be completely off the mark altogether.
Now, what about the other new particles whose discovery is suggested by these neutrino experiments?
Oh, yes, that's very exciting. That's the so-called dimuons and the mu-e events, which were also reported by Slack as well as by the neutrino people. And the interpretations are different. The Slack mu-e events have been attributed to discovery of heavy leptons. This would be the lepton family, as you know, stabilized at four leptons for a very long time. And
that's the electron, the mu meson, and two neutrinos.
Two neutrinos,
one corresponding to electrons, one to mu meson.
That's correct. That stabilized very uncharacteristically in our subject a long time ago. And if this is indeed a heavy lepton, then this would be the beginning of some structure in that set of particles. I have personal preference that these events can be attributed to colored integer charge quarks, and that one is probably seeing one species of quarks called the red quarks. And I made some comments about that idea today. The events which the neutrino people are seeing are possibly manifestations of charm. They are not heavy leptons or possibly red quarks, but they are manifestations of either charm or color, or again both. So the same story which goes on in the sphere data and the slack data. It seems to be going on also in the neutrino things. Although there is one characteristic difference. In the decay products at slack, the evidence for charm is rather small. Also, Ting gave data from proton laboratories, and there also the evidence for charm seems to be small. On the other hand, the neutrinos seem to be more effective in producing charm, so that a curious situation seems to be arising that whereas photons and protons are rather reluctant to produce charm directly, the neutrinos appear to be more potent in this respect.
Is there any reason to...
No.
Why that should be?
This shouldn't be.
That's a complete surprise.
And this may point out that we are perhaps not looking at the whole thing in the right way.
Now, when you say that the experimentalists have been producing charm, really all this is inference, I take it. The actual particles themselves.
Well, the signal for charm is the strange particles called the K mesons. As soon as somebody sees a few K mesons, he says, charm. Now, Ks have been absolutely conspicuously absent in slack and in the proton laboratories. So although there was the indirect attribution of the Psi's and J's, etc., to charm, anti-charm production, the conspicuous absence of the K mesons made life very hard. This is not so in the neutrino experiments. There the K mesons are being produced, and in fact, to one's amazement, you seem to see not just one K, but several Ks, multi-Ks. And there is a profusion of charm, if you like, coming along. It may not be charm, we may be just interpreting. So all that, when somebody says charm is being seen, all he means is he has seen a strange particle.
Yes. How long is it going to take, at a guess, to provide a theoretical framework in which all this will sit
happily? I don't think one can really provide an honest, decent theoretical framework till some more facts are available. And this is this profusion of facts. But at the same time, there are enormous gaps so that one cannot make a consistent picture at the present time till more data is available to really fill the gaps. For example, unless we know there are 8 particles or 9 or 10, unless the situation stabilizes, impossible to theorize.
Professor Abdus Salam describing the extraordinary situation that's now arisen. The high-energy physicists know that something must be changed and suspect that the necessary change in the framework of our understanding will be quite radical. But for the time being, they're hamstrung. The new data are enough to show that tinkering with existing theories won't suffice. But they aren't yet enough to guide people confidently to a new framework of understanding. My own guess, for what it's worth, is that when the job is done, the whole notion of the unobservable quark will disappear. It's thoroughly unsatisfactory that the existence of particles of matter as we know them should be explained in terms of other particles whose existence hasn't yet been demonstrated, and which indeed may not exist at all. For the time being, then, the initiative lies with the experimentalists, and for the year or so ahead, the experimentalist will have to rely on the particle accelerating machines that exist already. David Klein's explained how people like him are trying to wring new information out of machines like that at the Fermi lab. But ultimately, somebody'll have to build more powerful machines, working at still higher energies. More powerful, for example, than SPEAR, which is linked with the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center Salam referred to. So I asked Burton Richter whether he's hopeful that funding agencies and the American government in particular will be sympathetic to the claims that he and people like him will be making.
Of course I'm hopeful. If I wasn't hopeful, I would go and, become an electronics technician or a plumber or something like that. But I think high energy physics will be backed in the U.S. at a level about the same that it's backed now. And I think the high-energy physics community in the U.S. will have to make internal decisions about where they're going to put their priorities and resources. I think these new discoveries have had an impact in the funding agencies in the sense that I believe the erosion of support in the U.S. has stopped. And we do have a new accelerator, which is in the process of approval. The approval is not final yet, but it looks like it will be approved. And that's a new higher energy E plus E minus machine. What will happen in Europe, I don't really know. What will happen in Britain, in particular,
well, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, what's your view of the British scene in high energy physics just now?
Well, I think the British science policy makers have continued their historic course of choosing to do things which are not terribly interesting. The British physicists at the Rutherford Laboratory proposed a high-energy E plus E minus machine, sort of on the scale that we are proposing in the United States, and they proposed it several years ago. The science policy people, I think it's the Science Research Council, procrastinated for several years and finally said no. And so two such machines will be built. One will be built at the DAISY Laboratory in Hamburg. One will be built in the US, and none will be built in Britain. Economic problems in Britain, I don't understand. I'm a foreigner. I don't know enough about your economy to know how critical the shortage of funds for science is. But Britain has had a tradition of building second-best machines for quite some time. The Nimrod machine is a very good machine for what it does, but when it was built, it wasn't the interesting machine to build. The Darsbury synchrotron is a very good synchrotron, but I've always found it very strange that with a 7JeV machine working in Germany and a 6JeV machine being shut off in the US and a 12JeV machine running in the US and a 20JeV machine running in the US, Britain decided to build a 4GeV electron synchrotron. It's another example of a machine which is not very interesting, consuming the talents of some very good people to build it and make it run, and getting some results out with enormous effort by the physicists, and results which I am afraid to say are generally greeted with ho-hums in the scientific community. They are important and useful, filling in the nooks and crannies. But why Britain, with its core of very good particle physicists, of very good machine physicists, has chosen never to do anything that was really on the forefront of the field is something which has puzzled me for a very long time.
Burton Richter's view of British high-energy physics will give offense not just to the high-energy physicists, who are proud of what they've accomplished in the past few years, even with inadequate resources, but also to other kinds of scientists who think that high-energy physics has been, if anything, too generously treated in the past few years. That last view is now, by all accounts, accepted by the Science Research Council and by the Advisory Board on the Research Councils, which has recently declared that big science, as it's called, should take a smaller share of the funds that are available. But is it really right and proper that British physicists should in the process play only a peripheral part in what promises to be one of the most important developments in physics for half a century? That's a question I'll be putting to some of those concerned in the next program in this series 2 weeks from now.